Stage with Robert Emery.
Hello and welcome to episode number 12 of Backstage with me, Robert Emery. Today I'm thrilled to be hosting the podcast and interviewing the wonderful American tenor, David Miller. David, of course, shot to fame, especially in the UK, as part of the Il Divo supergroup, but there's an awful lot more to him than singing in that group, and we cover so many things in this podcast, it's quite astonishing, especially his beliefs on how to lead a happy and successful life. So, without further ado, over to David. So, David, hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. I thought it'd be a really interesting conversation to have with you because we work in a similar sort of field. I mean, I'm not a singer, I can't sing to save my life, but nevertheless, you know, I work with people like yourselves as a conductor and I'm used to the touring side of it, and it's probably just a bit more boring if I waffle on myself about what I end up doing as a touring musician, and it's far more interesting to speak with somebody like yourself. And I've just been doing a bit of research. So you're living in New York, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. How long have you lived there?
Off and on since the mid-90s.
Okay. And do you find it difficult with the other boys in the... What do you call them? I call them a band, not really a group.
A super group.
That's not, I like that. It's like superpowers, yeah. Do you find it difficult because you all, I assume, live in separate locations because...
Yes.
There's one from Switzerland. I spend 6 months of the year in Switzerland, so I love it over there. And there's a Spanish person and a French guy as well.
Yes.
So you're all over the shop. I mean, is it difficult to keep going as a group when you're all spaced out like that?
Not really. Most of the time we're on tour, and so it's really immaterial where we live. And for the rest, you know, we go home. And in the breaks, and we spend time, we completely unplug. We don't really even call each other or chat with each other unless it's something important that's coming up, like, you know, making decisions on the album that we might be working on, or making decisions on crew if someone becomes unavailable, or, you know, boring things like that. But for the rest, we just unplug, we go home, we spend our time, we recharge. And then we come back refreshed and ready to go again.
And how long do you spend on tour in a year, on average?
Depends on the year. We have album years and we have touring years.
Okay.
And the album years, most of that year is dedicated towards creating the album, of picking the repertoire, getting into the studio, laying down the vocals, you know, all the things that go into that. And that's usually a 7 to 8 month process between start to releasing the album. When we're on tour, it depends on the particular routing of the tour. We hit kind of sections of the world in one go. So, like, we'll go down and do Australia for a couple weeks, and we'll go and do Japan for a couple of weeks, Southeast Asia, and we'll do UK for a couple of weeks. Takes a bit longer around South America, takes a bit longer around North America, but we take them in chunks. And so sometimes, depending on the availability of the venues, those chunks will all be back to back. I remember there was one year, I think it was 2012. It was a pretty hard slog that year. We were at one point on the road for 6 months straight. After that we kind of got in the mode of like, look, that's insanity. We almost killed each other at that point. So now we try not to go much beyond five weeks at a clip.
And I know that feeling. I mean, in 2011, I totaled at the end of the year the number of flights I took, and it was on average one flight every 3 days. And it gets to a point where you just can't do it. Your body and your mind just can't cope with that. It's just a bit.
It's numbing. It's mind-numbing. And it becomes routine, and it becomes... even though, you know, the circumstances change, the environment changes, but you are doing the same thing every day. It becomes very repetitious and mind-numbing.
Did you ever have that feeling? I always hated it, that when you wake up in the morning and you know you're in a hotel room, but because you've travelled so extensively, you for the first moments of your slumber when you're getting up, you actually have no idea which country you're in, which time zone you're in, let alone where the bathroom is in the hotel room. Do you ever have that horrible, freaky moment?
I call that being in the now. Because there is, you know, in the now, in the esoteric idea of being in the now, there is no time and space. So those are actually glorious moments to have. They're very confusing and very disorienting, because we are creatures of habit. But yes, I do have those.
Yeah, I find it freaky personally. So you started off in high school musicals.
Yes.
Which I'm thrilled to hear, which is really nice. And then you went to a conservatory of music in, how do you pronounce that? Oberlin,
yeah.
There we go. And you did a Bachelor of Music there. So actually you did train as a tenor, I assume?
Yes, trained as a tenor. I found my voice through the musicals. I had been musical since I was a child. I learned to play trombone at the age of 8. And was a bit of a musical prodigy in that. And by the time I was 9, I was first chair in the high school orchestra. And that...
Sorry, back up a bit.
Yes.
Why on earth the trombone, out of all?
Well, no, that's an interesting story. When I was 8 years old, this was back when we did, in America, have music in schools, public schools.
Okay, so it's a problem over there as well as here.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a bit of an emotional crusade that I have about seeding young minds with music, and specifically classical music. But we may come back to that. So I was, our school and all other primary schools around Denver, which is where I was growing up at the time, we were bused in regularly, like once a year, maybe twice a year, to go see concerts playing downtown. And this particular concert was John Williams conducting John Williams.
Wow.
And I was a huge Lucas fan and Spielberg fan. And so this was part of my musical framework in my mind of what I was exposed to as a child, these movies that had these glorious soundtracks. And I was sat, our school was sat over by the brass section. And sitting there, you know, when Darth Vader's theme comes on, bom, 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 you know, whatever, that was viscerally coursing through every cell of my body, these vibrations. And it just, I was like, I want to do that. So I told my parents and I said, I want to play trombone. And they looked at me like, are you insane? But I had two amazing parents who were supportive of all three of us kids doing whatever it was that our passions led us to. For me, it was music. So they found and leased a trombone for me, found a teacher for me, and my teacher stepped up for me and helped me get into the orchestra and kind of set up an entire paradigm around that. But it became a certain point where the teasing from the older kids, the high school kids that I was playing with, it got to be too much for my psyche, so I ended up quitting and rediscovered music again when I got to be their age in high school, and also found that I had a throat that could do things. Mm. And I had a choir teacher who was very encouraging of me and said, come audition for the musical. We need guys in the chorus. And I didn't do it the first year. I had other stuff going on. I was on swim team, and so I was trying to go the athlete route, which I got bored of that very quick.
Yeah.
And so then I did audition for the musical, and they actually gave me a part. And that was so much fun. Not just finding that I was a singer and being able to explore that, but just the mentality of artist kids and theater kids. Was something new and interesting for me, and I made a lot of friends, and so it was a social thing as well. And that kind of became a natural evolution and a passion for me, so I then found a proper voice teacher, and she had studied with a man named Richard Miller, who was a teacher professor at Oberlin. And so she kind of put her word in for me and vouched for me, and I auditioned, and with her recommendation and all of that, and I gave a good audition. So then I went to conservatory and studied with him for 5 years. And as you said, I got a bachelor in voice, and also stuck around for an extra year to get a master's of opera theater.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the John Williams angle, because he's a great inspiration for me in his writing and orchestrations in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago called Classical Music is Dead, Long Live the Dead. and in summary to the podcast, I talk about the fact that classical music as we know it as a genre, I think, is dead, because it has to move with times and it has to be more accepting of other styles of music which are orchestral, which other people may call classical. And, you know, that we should really try and find a new terminology for the classical music, because it's got such a... it's got such a negative connotation with people. Whereas if you say to them, listen to this film score, they'll love it. And
right.
You can say, well, in my humble opinion, I really feel that John Williams in 150 years' time will be put next to the Beethovens and the Mozarts of this world as a classical composer. I mean, I get the feeling that you don't necessarily agree.
Well, I don't know. I'm digesting what you're saying. I've not heard it put like that before. I would say that the word classical, for me, really refers towards structure, certain types of structure. And, you know, there was the scientific thing back in the 90s, can't remember the guy's name, but he basically came up with the idea of the Mozart effect and did studies about how specifically Mozart's music, I think other classical music, other classical earlier genres as well, has an impact on the organizational capacity of the brain and lights up certain parts of the brain, whereas other types of music don't. And it's more to do with the way in which the nature of the combination of the vibrations in patterns, and as those patterns repeat and as they variate and all of those things, it causes the mind to go into simultaneously memory and creation. So you follow this melody as it goes along, and then when you hear it the second time, your brain goes, oh, I know that, but it's different. And so it goes into a variation, and your mind all of a sudden explodes into possibility land and that quantive thinking mode. And I do believe that, I agree with you, I think John Williams in 150 years' time will be considered a classical composer in terms of like lumping it into the larger word we use of classical music. And music does change with the times, and I think to a degree what you're saying is true. Classical music in the strictest sense is dead, and I think it died around the Schoenberg Berg as things progressed into the 20th century, because as you said, music is a reflection of the emotional sociology and the mental sociology. And as we moved into the mechanical age, the connection that we have with the natural world around us started to deteriorate. And that's where so much of the vibration that we created orchestrally and musically came from. I'm totally diatribing right now. Just realized how long I've been going on this thing. No, I'm a complete music nerd. And so, like, my time at conservatory, we spent a long time delving into all these things.
Yeah, gave good training for it. No, I like that, because I think one of the sad things about the world of classical crossover, if there is such a thing, is that people have an... classical purists have an instant dislike for the world of classical crossover, because they think that a lot of the performers in it haven't trained or worked as hard to get where they need to go. And it's really refreshing to hear somebody who is spouting out wisdom, knowledge, and has the training, and yet, you know, works in that field. I just want to touch on a couple of things, because you seem a very humble guy. And I know when we spoke over email, you were saying, yeah, I'm happy to talk about anything. There's some incredible things down here that you've done. In 98, you performed along with some other opera singers for President Bill Clinton at the White House. I mean, that's an astonishing achievement early on in your career, let alone what's happened after that. And then the thing that really ticked me and interested me is in 2002, you were starring on Broadway in Baz Luhrmann's Le Bohème. And this was all well before Il Divo even existed.
Mm-hmm.
How did, aside from meeting your future wife, how did the Broadway experience treat you? I mean, did you really love it? Or was it an incredible...
I was devastated when that show came to an end.
Mm.
My training was entirely classical in nature, And I received the structure for not only expanding my musical knowledge, but my vocal technique. You know, for me, it all boils down to structures. You know, whether it's sculpture or art or even just looking at sociological interaction, the way in which we speak to each other now, our structures and forms of using language are deteriorating because we have such an influx of so many structures going on all at once, and such access to the myriads and multitudes of knowledge that's out there via the internet, that it's reducing our ability to communicate in terms of structure. And so for me, I was a classical purist, absolutely 100%, because this was what defined my world, these structures.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And opera was the only true art form for a vocalist of my caliber. And like that, like a real dick. You might have to bleep that out. I don't know.
No,
I don't know if you do that on podcasts.
No,
but,
fine.
You know, I was a real snot about it.
Yeah.
And when I got to Broadway and I was exposed to Baz and his particular unicorn genius.
Sorry, what do you mean by unicorn genius?
Well, unicorns are magical and genius is genius.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah, there are certain people around the world that I call unicorns because they defy all logic, they defy all rationality, and they are successful and artistic and whimsical, and everything in this world says, no, you have to have hard work and dedication and la, 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 la.
Yeah.
So his whole approach, you know, as an opera singer, what we're trained to do is to use the structure of our physicality to produce sound that goes all the way to the back of the hall with no amplification, fill that hall, and those people in that back row of that top balcony are going to have just as great of an experience as the people in the first row. And so it was all about projection, throwing it out there, blowing people back into their seats. And his approach, coming from first an operatic background, because he worked with the Opera Australia and had created the La Boheme back in 1991, and then going through an entire film career as a director and learning how to draw performances out, because when you're up on the big screen, everything's magnified for you. You don't have to show so much, you can be. And he was finding the hybrid sweet spot between showing and being, more erring towards being, which was completely different for me as an opera singer. You know, you get up there and you, you know, it borderlines on melodrama.
Yeah.
You must pay the rent. I can't pay the rent. You know, all of that stuff where you're just showing all your emotions.
Yeah.
And he was able, he said, you can blow people back into their seats, but isn't it more interesting if they're hanging off the edge of their seats, off of every word that you're saying, that you only really sing loud enough to get their attention pulled into you. And that freedom vocally of not having to always be at, you know, maximum capacity all the time, which requires all of your attention all the time just to sing those notes.
Yeah, and it's not terribly musical either.
Well, it can be.
Like,
it depends.
It's loud all the time.
Agreed. If it's all loud all the time, it's not musical. But it's more, why are you singing loud? Not just because it's his forte, but, you know, what is it emotionally that's causing him to be loud and the orchestra to swell up into forte? What is causing, what's behind those markings? What is Puccini intending that he says, oh, well, the music needs to go here now? And delving into so much of the emotional intricacy that we had the space to create real people on stage and create real relationships on stage. And the drama that we created was so much more powerful as a result. And what it did was it said, all right, you've got that musical structure in place. That's fine. Great. That's not going anywhere just because you're exploring this. No one can take that away from you. So what if you explore this? And if I hadn't done the La Boheme on Broadway, I never would have auditioned for Olivo. Mm. Never would have even considered when they said, I said, what are you looking for? And they said, we want opera singers, but you're not going to sing opera. I would have turned around and walked out the door immediately. if I had not gone through this process of realizing that there are more avenues for the voice to reach people than by blowing them back in their seats.
Would you ever, I mean, I know you're a tad busy at the moment, but would you ever consider going back onto the Broadway stage or even here in the West End and doing another run of something new?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's like you said, I have scarcity of time at the moment. And who knows what the future holds, obviously, but at the moment, in this now, there is a scarcity of time. So I do look for projects to be on the stage and be in my kind of most natural environment. Mm. I find Il Divo to be very unnatural from this perspective. It's so natural, it's unnatural.
Yeah.
There are no characters, there are no costumes, it's just us. And as in that department, what we're faced with is trying not to become caricatures of ourselves, because it's really easy. You find what works, you do a thing, you get a laugh, you do another thing, it doesn't get a laugh, you learn what to do, what not to do. And of course, you only want to get the laughs and you want to get the applause and the standing ovations, whatever. So you start doing only those things. You stop experimenting, you stop being yourself, you start becoming a caricature. So that's our own hurdle and challenge that we have. But I love becoming a character. I love telling a story. I think that's my primary impulse for all of this, is storytelling. That's music in its purest form is storytelling without words. It's direct connection to the musical impulses that we have as human beings. I would love to, you know, work opera back into the rotation. I would do music theater if something very interesting came along. 100%.
And talk about storytelling. You're now also a sort of a director and a producer and a videographer.
Yes.
And all those other words.
Yes. all those other words.
I mean that's all about storytelling, isn't it? I mean, you've got your new website set up, and I've had a look at that, and I just want to read something from that, which is going to be terribly boring for you, but I think it's really interesting for everybody to listen to. You say, "I recognize the arts, not necessities of life in the same way as food and shelter, clean water and clothing. They're necessities of survival. Art and music are portrayals out of survival mentality and into prosperity consciousness. However, these openings come with a cost. It takes great devotion, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and monetary, for an artist to create great works of art. It's a continual learning process that takes years to cultivate and requires a lifetime of study and practice. This devotion for an artist wishing to reach the level of a virtuoso is by no means free. Every artist makes personal sacrifice to remain true to their calling as they search for an audience desiring to support them in their pursuit of excellence."
That sounds so much better in your accent.
Yeah, I don't know whether everybody will agree with you. I love that. I think that is superbly written, really.
Thank you.
Because one of the things that slightly narks me about being a professional musician and earning a relatively good wage from that is sometimes the negative press that one can get about how much one gets paid to do a concert. And very often they don't factor in the decades of time, devotion, practice, heartbreak that you have to do and put through to be able to become that professional musician. And I think that is so eloquently put. In relation to that, that's on the website. What is the website? Just remind me.
Bohemisphere.com.
There we go. So you've turned into the film of medium, into the medium of film, sorry. And I see you getting a lot of awards for this. And I'm also thrilled to hear that, because I think it's really nice that, you know, you're being recognised as a professional in that field, not just a singer who can tour the world and do a bit of video on the side. So I'm thrilled by that. But what was the impetus to do that?
The impetus came, it's been a very long process, and it's basically the culmination of my entire life experience of my musical journey since age 8 playing trombone. trombone led to singing, singing musicals led to opera, all of that training and structure that led to that career, being exposed to these masterworks and virtuosic productions and vibrations. For me, it all boils down to vibration. And I think that, you know, like we were saying before, the decay or decline of classical music is because the vibrations around us have changed. The jackhammers in the street, the planes going overhead, the white noise, the air conditioning systems, these are all vibrating at certain frequencies, and we are inundated and surrounded by all of this. And as such, we lose touch with the natural vibrations of the world, songs of birds, the wind in the trees, which is kind of like air conditioning. So my musical and vibrational journey through opera, just exposing me to such virtuosic heights of the ways in which music can elevate the emotional state and the mental state, and then landing the gig with Il Divo, and which was a complete left turn and very unexpected for me in my career. And thank goodness for the La Boheme that kind of prepped me for being willing to jump into something like that. And what I learned over those first couple of years, with camera in my hand, the record company said, and Simon said, "Oh, it's a shame we're not catching any of this. This is so unique." Simon Cowell, yes. So unique and so interesting. We should have sent a camera team out to that first recording session. And I said, "Well, I'm handy with a camera. You know, I'll catch what I can. I'll send it to you. You can do what you want with it." And continued on and just sort of caught what was happening. No real intention around that. But they didn't end up doing anything with it. And I was getting frustrated that I was, you know, catching all of these really interesting moments and no one was seeing it. So this was right around the time of Mac putting cameras into their computers and kind of giving video editing software, kind of bundling it as part of the package. So, iMovie, just dumped it all into iMovie and started pushing things around and just messing around with it. And simultaneously with that, with every making of the album, making of the tour, first time we went to Japan, first time we went to Australia, first time in all these things, where it was just general natural enthusiasm, nothing scripted. But it was like reality TV without the script.
But you obviously loved doing it, otherwise you wouldn't have spent time doing it.
Well, it was fun. It was fun. It was time consuming, yeah. and it gave me a pet project. Because once things are kind of on the rails, you've made the album, or two in the case of the first tour, we had done two albums, and then you go on tour, and then it's like touring a musical or an opera or anything like that. It is the show, and once the show is up and running, it is the same every day. So it gave me a break from the monotony to be catching the monotony, and then showing the world the monotony, but not in a monotonous way. And simultaneously with that, learning what a modern audience is looking for in terms of an evening of musical entertainment, which is the modern populist audience is the same as the opera audience. They're people. They want to enjoy an evening of musical vibration. And what they don't realize is what we're doing. You know, for the first few years, we were called an opera boy band, which is great. That's fine. I'm happy for people to call that. But we have never, ever, ever, ever touched the opera. We've never touched anything from that repertoire. It's always been straight down the middle of the road, pop music. We just give our classical spin on it.
Yeah.
And so what that showed me is there is a hunger and a desire for this more fully developed, structured vibration. And so combining all of these things all at once, I had a vision. And I was about to do a concert with Sarah Joy, my wife. We were going to go do a concert that was going to include Romeo and Juliet selections from a duet from the fourth act. So my thing, you know, to refresh my memory on music is to put it on in the background, cup of tea, you know, whatever. And as I was listening in this particular evening, I started seeing the scene happening in front of me, and I was asking myself, I was like, which production was this? What was that in? Was that Montreal? No, was that Trieste? No, was it? And then I realized I was inventing it in my brain. I was seeing it, and it looked like a movie. So I started scribbling it down, and I got really excited because all of a sudden I'm like, I'm seeing something that's never been before, the movie of Romeo and Juliet, starring me and Sarah Joy and a whole host of other people. And I went so far as to get a storyboard artist to help me render it out. And I pitched it to someone for funding. And they said, this is gorgeous. This is amazing. This is going to look pretty expensive and wonderful. And I think the people are going to love it. I'm not giving you any money. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, that doesn't compute. You said all the things work, ticked all the boxes, not giving me money. Why not? And she said, you're not a director. And I said, well, yeah, I am. And I showed her the 34 videos I'd made for Il Divo in the making of things. And she said, no, that's documentaire. That's fly on the wall. You're talking about narrative film. That's a whole other mindset. That's a different way of directing and a different set of needs. And you have nothing to show that you would know how to use the money I would give you to achieve this storyboard. And I said, okay, what do I do? And she said, you need to do something. Film a scene, maybe the bedroom scene, maybe film an opera scene. And so I remembered going back to my Oberlin days, my final directing project, which was A Hand of Bridge, the Samuel Barber. And I thought, well, I know that scene pretty intimately. And so I said, all right, here we go. And I put up my own money to get the thing filmed and pull together a crew. And I talked to Frank Boren, who was directing Il Divo's commercial, TV commercial for the Amor y Pasión album. I talked to him and I said, I'm working on a project. How do I get this off the ground? He was like, oh, I can help you. And he became my co-director. And he helped me pull all the right people in to get it done. And we came up with a storyboard and then filmed the whole thing. And it was such an involved process that brought all of my passion from every aspect of every musical endeavor I'd ever been a part of into one thing. And so I agree with you 100% that it went to festivals and that it did get awards. That's gratifying for my ego, but more important, it shows me that there is a hunger for classical music. And I think it's less about that, you know, the structures of classical music may be changing, but the hunger for structured music is still there. People want structure. People want structure in their vibrations. They come to Il Divo concerts for this reason. The people who go to opera is because they're familiar with opera. The people who come to Il Divo is because they're familiar with Il Divo. So my whole mission is to marry these two worlds. Take opera and give it to the people where they live. Yeah. It's much, much more accessible. It's less confrontational. People don't want to get dressed up in a tux, go see the opera. You know, we live in a very relaxed society these days. So take the opera and put it where they live.
You mentioned vibrations an awful lot. That's clearly something in your psyche, in your mindset. And that's a really interesting observation. I'm reading a book at the moment. I forget the author. It's called The Field. And it's by a scientist who discusses about how vibrational energy can change atoms, molecules. Mm-hmm. And it's slightly above my head sometimes, but nevertheless, I've only just started reading it, but I find it fascinating. This is obviously something very important for you. Where did you Can you tell me a bit more about what you believe in that and where you found the information or how you came to having that knowledge? Because quite often, if I said to, I don't know, my wife, hey, I'm reading this fantastic book about called The Field, and I know her reaction probably would be, yeah, what a load of rubbish, you know. It's nice to hear somebody else talking about that. So where did you get that information from?
Well, I had a very unique formative experience as a child. My dad was Navy, so very regimented, very structured. And my mom was, she wasn't an actual hippie, but she may as well have been for all of what she exposed me to. She was always on the hunt for the leading edge of scientific understanding that also corroborated with the old ways. So it was chiropractic, which at the time in the 80s was still kind of like not really such a common thing.
Yeah.
And it was macrobiotic food, and it was crystals, and it was psychics, and it was like, you know,
homeopathy
and acupuncture and all of these different things. And she even went so far as to enroll us, and this was really the first solidifying experience, in a Reiki course with a Reiki master. And at age 12, I learned how to move energy. And at a certain point, once I got to high school and I started finding music, that was, it's all the same. It's all vibration. So whether or not you're practicing the vibration of Reiki or you're practicing the vibration of playing a tuba, you know, it's all vibration. So music kind of filled that hole for me, not hole, but filled that department for me. And I wouldn't say I turned my back on it so much as it just became part of the framework and not really something to focus on. And it wasn't until, say, just before Il Divo, really, that I started reinvestigating all of that. And
are there any particular books that you can recommend?
In terms of vibration itself, not so much. But in terms of getting into the headspace and framework of being in touch with the feeling of one's own energy field. There's a book called Conversations with God, Neil Donald Walsh. There is a really interesting book called Destiny of Souls, and the author's name is escaping me at the second, at the moment.
I'll put it on the show notes. That's fine.
Fantastic. Anything by Wayne Dyer, Deepak Chopra, like investigate the populist, the people out there that you go, oh, you mention their name and you roll your eyes like, oh, that New Age hoobadoo. Any of them.
Yeah.
Any of them. Because they all point towards the same thing. You know, we can go so far as to talk about the disembodied consciousness of Abraham. But it all points towards Esther Hicks, who is the medium who channels Abraham. And it all points towards the same thing. You get in touch with the nature of vibration and you realize that you are the emanator, you're the broadcasting tower of the energy that creates the world you experience around you. Your five senses are interpreting the, for lack of a better term, the funhouse mirror that surrounds all of us, if you want to call it your aura or whatever. Mm. It's the mirror that surrounds all of us, the energy field, field. And your emotions and your mental field broadcast and then are reflected, and then you interact with that reflection and everything around you. And so your state of being directly influences what you interact with. And so your point of attraction can change molecules. If you are aware of it and in touch with it, your experience becomes completely different. Two people can be watching a sunset And one can be focused on the oil slick from the frigate that has just crashed ashore and going, oh, how terrible. And the other one can be actually looking at the sunset going, oh, how beautiful.
Yeah.
So you can be looking at the same thing, and depending on where you're at, you're going to see and resonate with different things. And it's either going to be terrible or wonderful. I choose wonderful on a moment-to-moment basis at, on every given topic.
So you're a glass half-full guy.
I'm a glass all-full.
All-full, great. I mean, I don't blame you, because, quite frankly, some of the stats I've got here as well about your career and about Il Divo are astonishing. In 2013, which is, I think, when you boys got together, you gentlemen got together, since then you've sold over 30 million copies worldwide. Your first album knocked Robbie Williams off the top spot here in the UK, which is interesting to hear. You've done things like you recorded the official anthem for the 2006 FIFA World Cup. You've performed around the world with so many different people. It's just mind-boggling. I mean, I think any musician would be slightly jealous, including myself, of some of the stats that I've got in front of me. Aside from the singing and the performing on Broadway and becoming a director and having film awards, what is there left for you to achieve? What is there left that you still haven't yet managed to achieve that one day you would like to?
I can only answer that question once that day arrives.
You're so in the now, aren't you? That's great.
I mean, there's...
Have you read a book called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior?
Yes.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, I read it a long time ago, and that's all about being in the now, and it's something which I always forget, and I got to train myself a little bit more to stop thinking about tomorrow and the future. And
you've reminded me of a couple other books, the Dancing Wu Li Masters and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Wow, okay.
These were two books that really kind of... They go a bit sideways, and they push you to expand into this direction.
Okay, I'm going to put those on the notes as well, because I'm going to get told off at the moment in a second for taking too much of your time. But I just want to push you a little bit more about this business of being in the now, because I personally am also a great believer in planning and having a wish list, big wish list, and. For instance, when I was 10 years old, I came to London for the first time. I saw a show called Joseph at the London Palladium.
Mm-hmm.
And as a 10-year-old kid, I saw the conductor down at the front. And in the programme, I circled, this is what I want to be when I grow older.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to 8 years later, I moved down to London to go to the Royal College of Music. I get a job in a church, just playing the church organ, just to get some money in. And the first person who I meet at the church...
Hang on, you need to back up a little bit. You don't just go from sitting in the audience to playing the organ. There were many steps along the way where you had to learn how to play organ.
Yes.
You went through an entire process.
Yes, that is true. But the interesting thing is, though, you know, I circled the person called Mike Reed and Mike Dixon in that program and said, this is what I want to be when I grow older.
Mm-hmm.
And after learning the organ, and I was already a pianist, I started playing piano at the age of 7, and I got into the Royal College as a pianist, and to put a bit of cash in my pocket, I thought it'd be clever to get an organ job.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, the first Sunday I was there, the vicar said to me, I'd like to introduce you to Mike Dixon. I think he might be useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the bloke that I circled as a 10-year-old kid in the program.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next week, the vicar said to me, there's somebody else who I'd like you to meet. His name is Mike Reed. I couldn't believe it. So I'm a great believer in, you know, the stars aligned for me then. The chance of this happening is so small that I'm a great believer. I put something in the universe. I don't know what. It sounds a bit woo-woo sometimes if I think about it, but nevertheless, it's what I believe. So there is something about planning and about wishing and about hoping and wanting.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that you live in the now, but if you only ever live in the now... That means you can't go, do you know what, one day I would love to do that and just throw it out there in the universe.
Sure you can.
Really?
That's what happens in the now. Those types of feelings are what happen in the now. When you're concerned with what might be headed coming down the road, you're out of the now. You're out of your vibrational alignment. When you're thinking about what has happened that will prevent you from what's going to happen, and you get into what's not happening now, you're not actually, you can say the words of this is what I want to do, but if you're not feelingly present to that, what could be called a rocket of desire, then you're sending other rockets of desire. You say, oh, I want that, but you're feeling about how, well, this person never made it, and that person never made it, and that thing happened when I was a kid, that means I'll probably never make it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. If that's all going on under the surface, and you're not in the... When you're in the now, you can catch that. You can see that that's there. You can move that out, and you can stay in pure, positive, creative potential. And when you're in that vibration... You're in the now, and when you're in the now and you launch those rockets of desire have to come true.
We should speak more about this another day. I'm fascinated by this. I've never quite met anybody who can explain it like that. There's some questions that I ask everybody, so I just want to whiz through them. They could be relatively short, sharp answers.
Fire away.
Tips and tricks you use to remain ultra productive and how you cope constantly being away.
That's a very good one. Sleep, primary importance. Hydration, primary importance. To be able to sing and do what I do on a daily basis. To keep me productive and to keep me focused, meditation. And I also get, I do energy work, whether it's Reiki or with the master that I work with, absentee.
How do you meditate? Because one of the things I find interesting is, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people from Stuart Copeland, the founder of The Police, through to, well, lots of different people. And one of the things, including business people, one of the things I find is the common link is meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use an app? Do you just do it naturally by yourself and breathing? What's your form of meditation?
I don't have any particular form that I'm strict with. I'm open to all forms. The general axiom is prayer asks the question, meditation receives the answer.
Good. I'm not going to say any more about that. That's very succinct. Your predictions of where the entertainment business, in particular the genre of classical music, classical crossover, maybe, the predictions of where that will be in 20 years' time?
That's really, that's a big challenge. We've seen so many changes, even just in the past, since 2007, since Facebook, right?
Go on, take a bet.
I think it's impossible to say. You know, we're already holding Star Trek communicators in our hands and in our back pockets. So, you know, if you look back 20 years, everything that's happening right now was all considered science fiction. So, if we look forward, it's still heading in that science fiction trend. So, you know, I think we're going to go through a phase of virtual reality. I think that phase of virtual reality will probably give way into holograph. Holograph will probably give way into implants. If you're one of the conspiracy theorists and you believe that we're already in a simulation and this is the Matrix, it could go anywhere.
Oh, I've not heard that one. That's I think you're probably right about the virtual reality and the holographs. But I suspect, like many things in life, it'll go through those periods and it'll come back round to a good old-fashioned live performance on the stage.
Well, I think
maybe including them, but
I think live performance, there is no substitution for live performance, because you come back to the idea of vibration, and all of these virtual worlds, they do provide a certain amount of entertainment, they provide a certain amount of distraction, and if done correctly, can provide a certain degree of realistic vibration.
Mm-hmm.
But they are, at the end of the day, copies. To be in a room with Plácido Domingo singing Que Gélida Manina and to have his unique vibration and oscillation of his vocal folds and in concert with the shape of the bone structure of his face, a mic cannot capture that.
Yeah.
No matter how good the mic is, you cannot capture how this all in the micro reverberations that are necessary between his bone structure, his vocal fold oscillation, the shape of a room, the instruments that are playing along.
Yeah.
You cannot replace in its entirety all of that information. There is no computer large enough that can hold all of that. You have to. It's an experiential thing, and this is why I don't believe that the live performance will ever be replaced.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. 10 quick fire questions.
Done.
With equally quick fire answers, please. Number one person you've never worked with that you always wanted to.
Steven Spielberg.
Oh, excellent. Number two, favorite venue in the world?
That we performed, that I've been, had performed at, or would just
whatever
like to.
Whatever you want.
Sydney Opera House.
I love it there. Do you know what? The first time I ever conducted there, they put it on a safety bar as a conductor behind your, on your podium.
Mm-hmm.
I always asked to remove it because I always feel constricted by it. And they removed it for the rehearsal. And I didn't realise, but they put it back on for the performance. So my trick is to run on stage, take a bow, jump onto the platform and start conducting. And it was an overture which I had arranged from West Side Story, started uh-huh. with Somewhere. And in my lift up to do my big downbeat, with my right hand, I'm a right-handed conductor, uh-huh. I whacked my hand off the bar.
Oh.
The baton flew across and hit a viola player. I did the downbeat like the biggest motherfucker of all time. And for the rest of the concert, I had to conduct with my left hand because my right hand was completely swollen.
Oh.
And that was my premiere at the Opera House in Sydney. I was so devastated. But do you know what? I'll never forget it. Number three, if you could have one thing in the world right now, what would it be?
Peace.
Number four, what is the proudest moment of your career so far?
Oh, that's hard. I'll go with La Boheme.
Number five, what's the worst moment of your career so far?
Sydney Opera House.
There's
a story around that. We'll come back to that.
Okay, number
time.
Six, piece of music you wish you'd have written.
No.
Nothing?
No.
Okay. Number seven, an instrument you wish you could play?
I believe once you learn the structure of a single instrument, you can technically approach all other instruments. So that's kind of I've dabbled in other things.
Okay.
I picked up the cello, I picked up the drums. I haven't tried any woodwinds yet, but all brass I can play, and it's just, I'm like jack of all trades in that.
You sound like Stuart Copeland. He does the same. He's got like 60 instruments in his studio and he just dabbles around. Number eight, the most inspirational person you've performed to or met?
Barbra Streisand.
Oh, wow. Number nine, what is your most treasured possession?
That's a weird one because I don't really subscribe to the idea of possession.
Well, that's your answer. That's fine.
Okay.
And last, number 10, the White House or Buckingham Palace?
At the moment, in the current now, I will pick Buckingham Palace.
I was going to do Donald Trump or Boris Johnson, but I thought that was really cruel.
We have a great house. It's a wonderful house.
That's freaky.
We're going to build a wall around the house.
A big wall.
And we're going to get Mexico to pay for it.
How can people find you, David? What's your socials?
At Bohemisphere, Bohemisphere, on Facebook. Also at Devo David Miller. And then, let's see, at Devo David Miller is also on
Instagram,
thank you. I'm not really on the social so much anymore, other than to kind of bringing my films out into the public.
Mm.
I went through a big phase of it right at the beginning, and it's just, I like Instagram better these days because it's really about people sharing. You know, a picture says 1,000 words and
mm.
you just do that, whereas Twitter just gets into like micro arguments and Facebook, because I see, you know, people posting this on one side of the fence and then it's the other side of the fence, and people playing tennis about
yeah.
It can be very divisive. I don't think that was the original intent.
Mm.
And so, but yeah, at Bohemisphere.
Fantastic. And in terms of Il Divo, you're in Sheffield tonight, so by the time this goes out, everybody will miss that. But then you're going off to Spain, and you're in Spain for half a month, in Portugal, Cyprus, Poland, Finland, Luxembourg, Russia, Switzerland, and the Hallstatt, and I love that venue, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, Israel, and Mexico. So you're all around the world, and I'm sure they can find you. David, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Hello, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening to that. I really do hope you enjoyed it. David's a fascinating person, and I can't wait to be working with him one day. As usual, I'd like to thank lat56.com for supporting me. They have fantastic, stylish, sturdy luggage. If you really need a good travel system, I would thoroughly encourage you to take a visit upon them. Whilst you're here, I have a very quick favour to ask. I'm really trying to push the podcast out to as many people as possible. So if you liked what you heard today, please do subscribe on the Apple Podcast website, or you can subscribe on www.thebackstageblog.com. And please tell your friends about it. Get them to take a listen and get them to sign up too. So from me, Robert Emery, I'm done for today. Ciao for now.
The Backstage Blog.